Hey gang, let's face it, you're probably listening to this show and all of your other shows on your phone. Well, are you tired of filling up your phone with all of your favorite podcasts? Well, try Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is an app that allows you to stream over 5,000 of your favorite podcasts and radio shows right to your smartphone or pad. You can download it for free at Stitcher.com or find it in your app store. Hey, I use it. I use it when I'm running. I used it when I was getting my oil changed the other day and I was just sitting around. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for listening. I have a great show for you guys today. I have a guy from here in Austin. He used to be in the Orange Mothers in the 90s. He is hopelessly original. He is refreshingly out of touch. He's an artist and a musician. He is Ethan Azarian. Fantastic musician, fantastic artist. You can find his music at ethanazarianmusic.com or at his art at ethanazarian.net. All right. He's got a project right now that he's doing with his old bandmate from the Orange Mothers, Jeff Johnston. They have a record out called Farmhouse Recordings. Fantastic album. Just a beautiful, beautiful album. Ethan's a great songwriter. He and Jeff make beautiful music together. And you can see that music if you live in Austin on Wednesdays at the Hole in the Wall. They do a happy hour from 6 to 8. I will be playing with them Wednesday, May 13th. I'll play from 7 to 8, but they'll play from 6 to 7 that day. Anyway, Ethan Azarian, great guy. We have a great conversation. We can't really figure out when we met. He has an idea of when he first saw me play, but I have this idea of us kind of hanging out at this coffee thing that used to happen at Quackenbush's in Hyde Park back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Great conversation with Ethan Azarian. Coming up pretty soon, okay? First, let me tell you what's going on. If you're in Austin tonight, May 1st, 2015, at the Cactus Cafe, my friend David Garza is putting on a thing called Chepo Fest. It's benefiting our friend Chepo Pena, who has come down with cancer. He is a great member of this community. He was in the band Sincola, and he played with David for a long time. But David is having a thing tonight. Get on out there. Chepo Fest at the Cactus Cafe tonight, May 1st, 2015. Get out there and support. And also, David's such a great entertainer. There'll be a lot of musicians there. You never know who will show up, even me. Huh? Me? What? I don't know. Let's see what's going on. Tomorrow, if you're in Austin, Skyrocket will be playing at the 1-to-1 Bar, a very special early show on Saturday, May 2nd at 8 p.m. at the 1-to-1 Bar. So come on out and see that. It's an early show for the Fogies. You know who you are. I hope you guys are all getting ready for a great weekend, and I hope that you're all enjoying this beautiful weather if you live in Austin. If you don't live in Austin, I hope it's beautiful weather wherever you are and not tornadoes and insanity like it has been. Okay, thank you so much again for listening to the show. I want to welcome all the new listeners. Don't forget, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, or you can find us on Stitcher. Stitcher is a great app for your phone or pad, and it just streams the shows. You stream your music on Spotify or Pandora. You stream your movies on the Netflix or HBO Go. Why not stream your podcasts on Stitcher? Great app. Okay, there's a second ad for it. Thank you guys so much for listening. Here's my friend Ethan Azarian and I having a great conversation. Don't forget, you can find Ethan Azarian's music at ethanazarianmusic.com, and you can find his art, Those Crazy Cows, at ethanazarian.net. All right, here he is. Let's talk to Ethan. Let's get down.
Nobody's home. Turn down all the lights. Barricade the front door. Don't pick up the telephone.
With Nina Singh.
Yeah.
Years ago at South By, and it was at that gay bar downtown.
Yeah. You know how hard it, like, that was one of my favorite places I ever played, and I went there the week after South By to see if I could get a gig there again, because I loved it. But yeah, remember that.
I was impressed. I didn't know who you got. I mean, I heard the name. But
yeah. We didn't know each other then? I thought that we knew each
maybe.
Other from Quackenbush's, sort of that.
Really? I don't
the
remember.
The late 90s, early 2000s Quackenbush's
maybe.
Mornings.
Maybe. Really? I can't
Yeah, because we were neighbors. You lived in, you still live in Hyde Park? Didn't you live like on Avenue H or something?
I lived on 51st Street. So kind of just outside, literally just the street away, on the other side of 51st Street by Intermural Fields.
Oh, right. You know what I have is notes. I don't usually read them the whole time, but...
Well, that was a great show. Like, I think Nina was, like, nervous, and you guys, she was filling in for somebody, right? If I recall.
No, we had lost our drummer, and we were about our record company was there. We were signed to the subsidiary of Elektra, and they were all there basically, like, let us hear your new songs and see if you get to stay. So we were all real nervous.
Right. I mean, it was a great show.
Yeah.
I was like, everyone was hitting their notes. The energy was good. There was people there, and I remember that show.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking Nina was awesome.
Yeah.
Like, she was just, you know, hitting hard, no tricks or whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
have you ever played with her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I just recorded at their, she's with Jeff
Botta.
Yeah. And I just did a session with him last week.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. We basically set up and played 4 hours a day, Monday through Friday. So we just kind of recorded the rehearsals.
Wow.
Which is really nice. Never listened to anything. Like, he was just in there. I don't know if it sounds good. I haven't heard it. So we'd just go like, here's the song. We'd be jamming the song. And then I did like 2 songs at a time. So like an hour, you know, like you would a rehearsal. Like if you were to teach me your set.
Yeah,
like you'd start with 2 songs.
Yeah.
You don't want to overload me. Like, let's just get these 2 down.
Yeah.
Then record them. Or he even recorded the whole thing, I think, because it's digital. The nightmare is now I have to go back and
listen to 4 days of
but it might be such a pain in the ass that I might just go, you know what, this sounds good enough.
Are you
F it, you know?
Yeah. You're free to cuss here. You're making a record or something?
I just made a record. I did Kickstarter 2 years ago and I took a long time to make this record. I recorded it in Vermont, like the vocal and the guitar takes. I brought you a copy. I'll leave you one before I go. I mean, I made a CD. No one listens to CDs. And I almost thought, do I want to put this out as a CD or do I want to, you know, I mean, I want something I can hold in my hand for all the money and the sweat, you know.
Sure.
So it's just something like, it's kind of strange to me that stuff's on the computer. I mean, I want something tangible.
It's weird because we come from a time when things were physical.
Yeah.
And you showed people a physical thing. Hold on, let me go get it. You know what I mean?
My first thing
you didn't
was
hold up your phone and go like, this is it.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I mean, I started making cassettes, you know, and you got the artwork and you close the little case. And
I had an Orange Mother's cassette.
Well, yeah, probably way back in the day.
I did, yeah. Yeah. I love that band. I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm a huge fan of Jeff Johnson as well.
Yeah.
Jeff Johnson's fantastic.
He is fantastic. He's a strange in a great way. Just,
yeah.
Strange is not the word. He's just unique person. And I know this because I've played music with him since 89. So we have 26 years.
Jesus, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
When you moved here?
I moved here in 89, winter of 89. So I missed all the Butthole Surfer. In the 80s, it was Big Boys, Butthole Surfer. I mean, I don't even know my history.
I was here a little bit for that.
Were you here for
that? For like a year, yeah, in the mid-80s.
Did you see the Surfers and Scratch Acid? Uh-huh. And it might have been...
I saw the Big Boys. I didn't see the Surfers.
Yeah.
I saw the Big Boys at Liberty Lunch.
By the time I moved here, the Surfers were too cool to play in town.
Right.
You know, I mean, they would play under weird names or... They didn't have to play in town, you know.
Yeah.
It was like they had gone, taken that other step.
What? Where were you before this? Like New York or?
No, I'm just a.
You were in Vermont.
Yeah, raised as a farm kid in Vermont.
I thought I read though in your bio that you had kind of moved to some different places or by way of New York or.
No.
Or you just went through there.
No, we went to New York. You live on the East Coast; everything's close together. So we'd go to Boston and play, New York and play, Philadelphia. You know, just go down the East Coast. But I was born in rural Vermont and lived there till I was 26. I was 26 when I moved to Austin.
What is it like growing up in rural Vermont? I've never been to Vermont, so it seems like this weird, kind of like extremely peaceful place with very nice people it has this like I have this Ben and Jerry's vision of it,
yeah.
Where everyone's being nice to each other and like. ecological and doing things for the world, and everything's green and beautiful until it freezes.
Yeah, that's all what you've said is true about Vermont, and it's conservative, but I guess you'd say it's old-fashioned Republicans, old-fashioned conservatism.
Okay.
And at the time when my parents moved there in the 60s, it was definitely a conservative, but there was a big back-to-land movement in Vermont. So people from California or people from New Jersey would be moving to Vermont to live off the land, get off the grid, you know.
Is that what your parents were doing?
That's what my parents, yeah.
Were they hippies?
They were not hippies.
Oh.
Which is fine if they were hippies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
sure.
There were a lot of communes springing up in the area, northern Vermont. So you'd have, you know, you'd have the Republican farmers, and down the road there'd be, you know, a commune. Pie in the Sky was one. And the guy who ran that, his name was Pancake. Not Mr. Pancake, just Pancake.
Yeah.
And so I grew up in rural Vermont, and all my peers in high school or elementary and high school were like straight working class, for the most part, kids, you know. And here I am with my parents, who weren't hippies either. They weren't into the whole dope and acid culture and the tie-dye.
Yeah.
But they hung out with those people because those people were more interesting to hang out with than some of the just local folks.
Right.
It was all kind of a melting pot, you know, and it wasn't, Vermont's the whitest state, so there wasn't a whole lot of segregation, or we weren't even aware of that.
I mean,
you know, so there was just a lot of French Canadians because we're close to Canada.
Yeah.
And so I went to school with Ducharmes, LeBlancs, Benoints.
So your school, like, was it how many kids?
I had 20 kids in my graduating class.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
I went to the same school from kindergarten till I graduated as a senior. A lot of small towns in Vermont will take the small schools will all go to one school. So you have five or six small towns going to one school.
Right.
But Cabot, Vermont, which is where I was born and raised, which is also famous in its own right for cheese, Cabot cheese. You can go to HEB and get Cabot cheese.
Yeah.
Now. So I was born on that mountain where they made cheese. They made it in the bottom down in the town, all the farmers did. But at that time, I lost my train of thought. At that time, Cabot was real small, and it kept its own high school. And so, unfortunately, I think I was just kind of stuck in a real small high school. So we didn't have a lot of kids coming from anywhere. It was just real local.
Yeah.
And I still have friends from those days. And some of those friends have never left Cabot. They've lived there their whole lives, you know.
Yeah.
And, but for me, I moved to Burlington, which is the biggest city in Vermont, 40,000 maybe. And from there, I moved to Austin.
Okay. So when you're growing up in Cabot, where were you introduced to music? Like, how were you introduced to music? How were you introduced to art? Because, like, was there radio? Was there one station? Did you have no choices? Did you have to seek shit out yourself? Like, how did it work?
Well, my dad is a musician,
oh, okay.
so that was taken care of. My mom is an artist.
Oh, okay.
And she studied printmaking in college, and my dad's went to eighth grade, but started hanging out in the early 60s in coffee shops in Cambridge, Mass. And it was a whole folk revival.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he knew Taj Mahal, and he also...
That was like the time of Peter Wolf was kind of...
Maybe even before Peter Wolf.
Yeah, but he was kind of like a guy on the scene there. Wasn't he like a DJ or something, or helped
tons of
bands?
Maybe so, yeah, so. But my dad's coming from Appalachian folk music. He toured the South in the 50s, like finding people to play with and jam with. He took his banjo. He's primarily a banjo player. So I grew up with traditional folk music, which is a blend of all kinds of Irish, English, so like contra dance music or square dance music, I grew up just playing guitar and banjo in that kind of vein.
When did you start at, like, seven, you said you learned both of those, guitar and banjo?
I was six or seven in the 60s. Well, then my parents, I had big parties, and people would come from all over and camp out in the field. My dad had an 80-acre farm. 80 acres sounds like so much these days. And that was considered small. So people would come and they would spend the whole weekend, and it was people drinking and smoking pot and staying up all night. And as a kid, that was a lot of fun to witness.
Yeah, I saw that a lot too as a kid.
I loved it.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Get back in bed, you know. At the beginning of the stairs, sitting at the beginning of the stairs. So by the time I learned to play guitar, it was almost like a second language, because I just knew how guitar and banjo should sound, because I just grew up with that. So it was real easy. And then I had a little bit of natural ability, so that helped. You know, I got good pretty quickly. And then by the time I was a junior, I started listening to what you listened to, was Cheap Trick and Kiss and Aerosmith. Mama Ken, I think, was my first rock and roll album, the very first Aerosmith. Yeah. My buddy had it, and we smoked cigarettes in his basement. It's an old story that we listened to Mama Ken. And we listened. I liked the whole Kiss thing, but even then I was like, come on, these guys are just putting on makeup or whatever, you know. I was more into like Aerosmith, and then I was totally loved Van Halen.
What do you think? Have you seen any of this new? Have you seen any of this stuff online of them
Van Halen?
Over the last few weeks playing shows? They played a bunch of shows last week.
No, has it been good, I hope?
Oh, my God, it's so bad.
Is it really?
It's not that it's bad. Here, let me tell you, I want to talk about this with someone who loves Van Halen. Here's the thing is, David Lee Roth is like so, it's like real uncomfortable to watch him. He has this real weird kind of like manic energy now.
Yeah.
Like not before, you know what I mean? Like before he had a manic energy. And he was funny, and he was, you know, kooky. Now he's just kind of disturbing, and, like, Eddie is, like, physically kind of getting away from him and stuff. You can see it on stage. And then they don't have Michael Anthony anymore, and no one in the band can sing that high. And this guy Wolfgang, Eddie's son that's playing bass, perfectly awesome singer, but to hear those harmonies an octave lower, it's like you don't realize that the sound of the band is those, like, the drum sound, the guitar sound, and those voices together, that real high, you know, Michael Anthony thing.
Yeah.
To hear it all an octave lower just sounds real weird. And David Lee Roth sings completely insanely.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to what he's doing. They just put out a live album. Anyway.
Are they doing the old tunes?
Yeah.
I mean, you would have to.
Yeah.
And he's not, I saw like a picture of him. He didn't have long hair. He didn't.
Nope.
Yeah.
And he's kind of doing kicks and stuff. It's just, you know, I mean, how can you go around kicking like that at, you know, at his age?
Yeah. But everyone's watching for that.
Yeah. And
I mean, we want the old David swinging on a rope with a fake bottle of Jack Daniels or whatever. Right. Maybe it wasn't. Who cares?
Right.
And you're not going to get, there's no way they can and Eddie Van Halen was so, with the racing stripes on the guitar, and the style was just so like, it was just a moment in time.
Yeah.
Gone like that, you know?
Yeah.
I think he peaked when he, I mean, at some point he just got tired with the whole, it was so beautiful.
Right.
It was so innovative when we first heard it.
It was everyone else doing it.
A million other people.
Yeah, it's like Eddie Vedder was great, but then like a year later when everyone was trying to sing like him, you just started to resent him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm a fair weather fan, you know. I'm the same way with sports. I have a lot of teams I like. So I like Van Halen, but, you know, I saw them a couple of times, but I wasn't like racing out to buy albums or anything. Go ahead.
How do you attach yourself to a team in Vermont? There's no. What?
Oh, like what? Well, we, no, Boston.
Patriots fans?
Yeah.
Okay.
Red Sox. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Sure. Celtics.
So how did you start your first, like, what was it? Was your first band the Hollywood Indians?
Band was Hollywood Indians.
What kind of music was
no,
that?
No, my first band was called Azian, kind of in reference to my last name, which is Azarian.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, typical high school band, and we took ourselves too seriously. We had the logo, and we had the scarves on the microphone, and I wasn't the singer. I was just playing guitar. And we bought a PA system and an old rundown van, and we played, like, just in the central Vermont, and I don't know.
What were those gigs like?
Terrible. I mean,
really? There wasn't like that?
We didn't know what we were doing.
I know, but there's something so amazingly freeing. Like, you know, when you get off stage after, like, your first gig with a band, and there's this, like, It's almost like what I imagine it must be like to do heroin, because you're always trying to get that feeling again for the rest of your life.
No, I never had that feeling. It's different for me, Johnny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was just kind of like, I just saw the whole shortcomings of it all. I wasn't singing. Two of the guys in the band were really good musicians, and they played with their dad, and they played mostly country songs, but they could play rock and roll, too. So our situation was different. We weren't playing covers. We were doing all our own original stuff.
Oh, wow.
So at that time, you know, doing all your original stuff, and all your friends from high school were kind of coming to your gigs and looking at their feet and like, you guys are terrible, which we were, yeah. You know. But if we had been terrible doing like AC/DC covers or Police or whoever at the time, you know,
right.
That would have been one thing, because if you get drunk enough, you go, oh, I like this song, man.
Yeah.
These guys are okay.
Yeah.
I mean, close enough. But we weren't even doing that. We were doing like our obscure original stuff.
What was
all
it like?
Done very seriously, and like, here we are.
Was it,
you
like
know?
Art rock kind of thing?
Or no, was it was just hard rock.
Hard like, rock?
We were in the same vein as Aerosmith, I would say. Just hard rock. Not even metal. We didn't have a crunchy metal sound then. And maybe a little bit towards what you would call punk rock, maybe. Little. We were back then in Vermont, when the Police came out, they were considered punk rock in Vermont.
Right.
That first album, right.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously that wasn't punk rock. You know.
Did you get into punk rock back then?
I liked punk rock. No, it just seemed too loud and noisy and chaotic. But thinking back now, I think I would have liked the Sex Pistols if they came out now.
Yeah.
You know. But I liked the whole, I liked what it did. It opened up the doors for people to be able to sing out of key and not worry about the wanky guitar solos, not worry about everyone singing sweetly together like Styx and all that. Because all the cover bands were trying to sound like an album, and some of them were quite good, but I could never get to that point where I was singing on key consistently and playing amazing blazing guitar leads. So when punk rock came along, I was like, hey, okay,
yeah,
don't have to, as long as you're earnest, you've got some good lyrics, and the delivery's such that, you know, it's all about not sounding so professional. So I loved punk rock for that, and then I quickly got into Replacements. I think they were this kind of the same thing, Replacements and Husker Du.
Yeah,
you could be very poppy and have a wonderful sense of melody, but also be like all over the place with the guitar and crazy noises and thrashing drums.
Yeah,
and, you know, so like mayhem, but pretty mayhem.
Yeah,
and Replacements like perfected that
totally.
I think when they got signed to major labels, they started getting confused. Do we want to be like Tom Petty, or do we, you know, that album they made, Tim, was a good album. The one before that, Let It Be.
Yeah.
I think
album is amazing album.
That's amazing album. I love it. Androgynous, all those songs. I would have loved if they did a couple more albums just like that. Just left off with track 11 on that album and just kept going. But obviously that, I think, you know, those Westerberg's, whatever, like a lot of artists, you don't want to do what you've already done. You want to try something else. And I think at that time, the local Warner Brothers, everything was going to give them money, and we're going to set you up, and that's what you're looking for, you know.
Right.
And you don't want to be playing out of the van. But anyway,
I bet also they were one of those bands where they got signed because they were so outside the box, but when they got signed, they were trying to stick them in the box. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's well said, and I'm just hunch, but I know I would feel like I want to sound like Tom Petty, and I don't want to sound like punk rock, and maybe Westberg was thinking that too, like,
right.
Hey, I'm not just this drunk guy who's from the Midwest who's writing kind of outside the box song. No, I want to sound, you know, poppy, but I don't know,
right.
You know, yeah.
So did you get to see those bands there? I mean, did they go to Burlington?
I saw the Replacements when they got on the cover of the Village Voice. They were going up to the pinnacle before they broke up and Bob Stinson died. I saw them at the Danceteria in New York City. Would have been 86 or 87. Me and my friend went down to see that show. They were totally sober. Place was packed, but it was pretty boring because word was that they got on the, they didn't want to fuck the show up, right? They weren't, you know,
so
they're
the
playing at the Palladium Danceteria, I can't remember. It's a big place.
Yeah.
Maybe 1,500 standing, you know, people just standing there. So it was, I remember that show, and I just remember it was just kind of lackluster. Maybe they were just having a bad show, but they weren't like doing crazy cover songs, and they weren't like, you know, wheeling around drunk or anything. Right. And that's what we all wanted, of course. Yeah. You know, I was 20 or whatever, so I, you know. And that was kind of the thing with the Replacements. Like, sometimes they were like, we got to get this right, guys. Come on, you know.
Yeah.
You know. So it was uninspiring. And then I saw them later, after Bob Simpson died, they came to Burlington, and they were playing, I forget what tour, maybe Pleased to Meet Me or something. And that was a good show. But again, it wasn't, I never saw the Replacements at their best, which right. would have been.
In the early days. What's the name of that label that had them in Husker Du?
SST, early on, yeah.
Were you doing art at the time? Like, what were you thinking? Like, when you left high school, after high school, you moved to Burlington, right?
Yeah.
And what were you, what was, did you have a plan? Were you going to school or something?
No, I never, I didn't like school, so when I got, when I graduated, I was relieved. Like a lot of people,
yeah,
and my parents.
Me too. I couldn't believe that. Like, I felt like they were holding me back, like, from 8th grade on.
Yeah.
I was like, I gotta get out of here, man.
Yeah, that's the way I felt like.
I'm missing out.
I gotta get out of here. I think a lot of people feel that way. And my mom was an academic, but my dad wasn't, so I kind of got an earful, like, don't worry about school. Oh, you should learn some things in school.
Right.
But my parents, for the most part, really let... I have two other brothers. I'm the oldest. They really let us just kind of find our own way. They never said, you need to do this, or you need to think about that. We weren't brought up in a religious, in any kind of religious sense at all. We never went to church, or that was just considered kind of silly religion. If it was talked about, it was in a way that it's like, well,
yeah,
we don't believe there was a guy, or there's right. somebody up there kind of thing. So I just kind of left to figure out what I wanted to do on my own. And so I moved with a bunch of friends who are musicians and artists. We all got a big apartment in Burlington, and we were all 20, 21, 22, and we just decided to form a band. We also had one of the rooms in the house was called the Hallway Art Gallery, so we would show our paintings there, and it was just kind of an excuse to show work and have parties. And,
yeah.
you know, when you're 20, all of that's real easy and attainable, right?
Right.
Let's turn our house into a gallery.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's put the drums downstairs. We'll yeah. rehearse down there, and let's have parties. So that was great. I loved all of that.
Yeah, me too. At that age, that life yeah. is amazing.
I yeah. still remember it pretty vividly. And then from there, I got more serious about music, like trying to get signed to labels. That was the mid-80s, when the word alternative actually meant alternative.
Yeah.
And that sense of the word was like, these guys sound a little different. They're mixing all these different styles, and they're putting out their own albums. We did a couple of albums on our own. And we started to tour, and I knew nothing about the business at all. I mean, I'm not a business person. I'm more artist-oriented, I guess. So we were playing like Youngstown, Ohio, or Kent, Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go out to the Midwest and play like these small places where they would have bands like The Hole in the Wall here in Austin.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the middle of the day, you'd go into these clubs in the Midwest, and it'd be like Polish working class people, just working class people in general, like guys in their 50s and 60s.
Like working in the mines and the steel mills.
Or steel mills, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then at 7 o'clock at night, like, all the underage kids would come in and see the punk rock show.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
You pull up into this club and you'd be like, we're playing here? Really?
Yeah.
Like, these guys are going to hate us, right? But then we'd realize, oh, no, I mean, whatever, the kids are coming, which kept the bars alive.
Yeah.
So we would go to the Midwest and play. And after a few years of doing that, I became really disheartened and disgruntled, and it's really hard to keep a band together and all be in the same van kind of thing. So that got old real fast.
Yeah.
And then people wanted to do everything, so we just disbanded. And then I came to Austin and started doing music. But I was pretty pissed when I got to Austin.
You were pissed at the business and at the...
I don't know. I'm looking back now, it's just, you know, it's kind of, I had to go through this period where I was disenchanted with music, and because I didn't achieve the success I wanted, right off. It was a bitter pill to swallow. So when I came to Austin, I felt like I missed everything that happened in the 80s. In the early 90s, there wasn't much going on here, right? There was before Spoon. It was before even, Ed Hall was here.
No,
stuff was going on, but there wasn't it seemed fractured.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
The scene seemed kind of fractured, you know? Which now, looking back, seems like a real opportunity. If I hadn't been so pissed, all these things that I'm talking about are all contingent on timing,
yeah,
and how you're meeting people and your frame of mind. I've learned all that now. You know, when stuff happens organically and naturally, it happens organic and naturally, and it's usually a lot stronger than something that's contrived or something that's forced.
Yeah.
So it's all about just happening naturally, you know, and so. It's hard, it's hard to observe that, but we all kind of gravitate toward the path of least resistance. And if you really focus on that, then you can get in some good situations and you can see the opportunities. But when I first started doing music or self-promoting myself, I was just like, listen to this tape or I'll kill you, you know.
Yeah.
Call me back, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
So right there, I'm like, got that negative, like they're not going to like this. And I still fight this to this day. I always feel like I'm the guy outside looking in, you know, like, wait, don't forget me, you guys. I'm over here. I'm really good.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us feel that way.
Everybody feels that way.
Yeah. And I think
I bet
feel
even
like
Paul
that.
McCartney feels that way. You know what I mean? Like, he's making records with Kanye West and Rihanna at this point.
Is he really?
You know what I mean? So he's like,
he feels the pressure. Otherwise,
like,
he wouldn't talk
somebody
to Kanye.
Like me. Come on. Yeah.
He's had his day in the sun. Move on.
But I think of a guy like that probably still has a lot to say. Like, to me, I think he's never stopped really being a guy that makes stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he's constantly making shit.
Yeah.
And that's an inspiration. You know, there's guys like that, like, you know, like...
Prolific.
Very prolific. Hey, what was your art like when you were living in Burlington with those guys? Like, what did it look like? What were you doing then?
Well, I'm untrained, so I was just kind of... I would paint little houses, and I wasn't painting cows then. And it was... I would do, like, sunsets and water, but I don't know. I was just kind of experimenting. And being untrained, it was... It's hard to describe. It's hard to describe my art even now. It's not conceptual. It's just kind of whimsical and surreal.
Yeah.
I would do things from my childhood, which would be Green Mountains. Vermont's famous for Green Mountains. But I might stick, you know, some kind of cow walking. Well, I don't know.
There's a nice... I had a postcard from a show that you were doing, like, in my studio from back when I lived in Hyde Park that you gave me, and it was in there for years, and I always loved it. It has, your art has a good feeling.
Yeah.
You know?
I have a sense of humor.
Yes.
And so it comes out in the art, and I have a good sense of humor and a good sense of composition, and I like working with colors. And so I've done that for 25 years. So I'm working with color constantly. I'm working with composition. And the content is kind of secondary. So the content would be things in my childhood, like ladder-back chairs, Green Mountains, cows, coffee cups, sheep, chickens, farmhouses and barns, and I just sort of incorporate all of those things in any given painting. And sometimes the barn will be flying in the sky, or the chicken will be on the ground upside down. I like to put little circles, colorful little circles.
Yeah.
And so there's no meaning to any of it. It's just kind of to be enjoyed in the moment. And I really think about this because the art world is really hellbent on things being conceptual. It's mm-hmm. always been, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's not good enough to do a nice painting of a covered bridge with some clouds in the sky. I mean, it looks nice, but people aren't interested in that. I mean, the art world at large is not interested
in that.
Right?
No, I know exactly what you mean.
And I'm not that kind of painter either. I can't paint a nice covered bridge, or I can't do like Southwestern scenes with cactus and I mean, I would if I could, but that's not what I do. So I'm kind of caught in this weird vortex of things from my childhood that I paint. And I guess you'd say it's cartoonish and surrealistic. But like you said, it has a sense of humor, which comes through and has lots of warm, beautiful colors. And my technique and skill level's gotten to be really good now because I've been doing it for 25 years. Yeah. And so, and in Austin, I was able to sell my work out of my home. And that's how I make my living, is doing art, not music. But long-winded answer here, I don't know, I'm rambling on. Music is really my first love. Like, I feel more confident writing songs and performing them than I can consider myself a painter. So it's kind of weird because I make my money from painting and people see my paintings, but I don't really have anything to say about them. I just do them as it's kind of like my day job. but I really want to, I'd love to go to Europe, and like me and Jeff to go to Europe.
And play.
And I'd love to be able to sell some music on the internet. I guess that's where we're going these days. And I'd like to do some touring. I mean, I'd like to sustain myself on some level. I love playing out live. And that's always been my goal. And now at 51, I feel stronger about it than ever, which is good, you know.
And
I'm about to start being prolific as hell, musically. Because the way I've been able to sustain my living doing art is being prolific. Like, I paint all the time. I'm always making new stuff, putting it on the internet. And that's how I've been able to sustain a living so I want to do that with music as well. I just finished an album, and now I'm just finishing up another album. And I've never done that. I was like, yeah, you have to put the time in it. You have to write every day or close to it. And so I'm going
to
see.
That's probably why you got to a point where you feel so confident with your painting too, is because it's like, you know.
Yeah, you know this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't run a marathon unless you run every day.
Yeah,
I mean,
you really have to put the time in.
Everything in your body
is
some kind of muscle that needs to be worked.
Yeah. It's nice to take a departure, but anyway.
Do you keep, do you know who Jay Joyce is?
No.
He's a producer, guitar guy that lives in Nashville, but he's also a painter, and he gave me this advice, because I mean, I paint too, but not like in any way. It's more for fun.
Yeah.
But he was like, you know, the best thing you can do is keep two rooms with everything ready to go, so you can just bounce. Like, when you can't make music,
yeah,
paint something,
yeah,
and then, you know, vice versa.
That's good advice.
Or maybe that'll inspire you to make some kind of music or something.
That's good advice, because if it's not set up, the thought of setting up your easel or setting up your music room can be almost enough to make you know
what to do.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I don't paint for, like, say, 2 weeks, and I got to go set everything up, get my paints out, get the water, whatever, it's like, that's a hard half hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like if I kept everything put away in here, you know what I mean? And I wanted to make a song.
It's hard
to get.
It'd take
me 30 minutes to get it together.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, but all of the doubt and the fear, like, can I do this? Am I going to make a good painting? Am I going to write a good song? That's all coincided with setting everything up, right?
So you're like, oh, you can talk yourself out of it.
You can talk yourself so easily. I need like a couple hours before the juices are flowing. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
I know
you're,
exactly.
You're
what
laughing
you
in agreement.
No, people don't understand that. I was with a girl that was like, just sit down and write a song. I'm like, dude, it takes, there's an hour of like walking around and saying stuff to yourself that is involved,
totally,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, you don't understand. I got to get into a place.
We all have to get into a place. And it's easy to get into that place if you force yourself. Which
if you're
is
doing
not a
it
bad
every day.
If you're doing it every day. I do an hour. If I'm in writing mode, I do an hour. Last time I did an hour a day for a week, and then I bumped it up to 2 hours. So I did a morning session for an hour and an evening session. And in 2 weeks, you know, you're going to have some melodies and lyrics and some stuff that you really like.
Yeah.
And sometimes a whole song, as you know, comes right out, right?
Well, I started this 30.
That's awesome.
30 and 30. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Was this a while ago?
You write 30 songs in 30 days.
Yeah, I think I heard about this. Will you have like meetings or something? People got together?
No, that's Bob Schneider has like a songwriting game where you get a title and
you have
to write a song
to it and
turn
it in.
But this is like just like, you know, whatever. You just write. And I did it for 7 days straight, and I hadn't written that like that in a while.
Yeah.
You know? And I thought it was going to kill me, but I stopped after 7 days because things got... It was hard to get back into it.
Yeah.
But I need to try and do it again.
Was it fruitful?
Yeah. I mean, I got one good song out of seven. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, absolutely.
One song I would probably play in public.
But see, now envision if you keep going with that.
Yeah.
And you did a month of that.
I'd have four or five good songs. That's great.
Yeah. I don't know, like, you can't, it's not like you can just put it in the oven and it's going to come out. It's just like one day you might get two tunes.
Yeah.
Or a lot of times I'll take one song and make two tunes out of it. There's all kinds of combinations. But the thing that's scary for me personally is I'm afraid of what happens when it dries up. Like, are there any more songs? If I've written two or three songs that I really like, I just feel like possibly can't be any more, you know? And I get to a point where I need to not do it and take a week off. But like I just said earlier, I want to be prolific as I am painting. So I'm just putting this into practice in the last 3 or 4 months. So I'm a little worried. I don't know if I can be as prolific, you know? We'll see. Yeah. I like this album I just recorded at Nina. So, but you tend to like the last thing you did. And it could be total shit, but you're like, no, this is the new stuff. Man. Yeah. You gotta listen to this stuff.
It's weird.
And
to
then
be
a year later, you're like,
stuff.
Oh,
I can't believe
terrible.
I did that.
No,
yeah.
Whatever. This is the new stuff. That keeps happening. But that's just the process, right? We're all like that.
Yeah. I think we're all like that.
That's the big thing is you play in front of, play the old stuff. Oh, I don't want to play the old stuff ever again. That's not true. Sometimes when you go back, someone will request a song, and I'll go, you know what? That is a good song, and I'll play it, and I'll rewrite it somewhat.
Yeah.
Do you do that? Will you rewrite stuff just so you can perform it again and not be like, got to change this fucking arrangement?
You know?
All you need is, like, changing a lyric or an arrangement, and, like, and then suddenly you take that song back and go, yeah, this is fun to play.
Yeah.
I love that. I love digging an old song up and maybe changing it. Maybe not, but often I'll change it a little bit so I can perform it and feel good about it.
Yeah. You know? Sometimes when I get really, like, discouraged, like, I have done nothing with my life. I'm fucking, you know, 46
that happens every day,
years old,
doesn't
and I'm
it?
Terrible. Well, sometimes when it happens really bad, and I bet you can do this too, sometimes I will just go back and, like, go through shit that I've done for the last, you know, 25 years. And go like, wow, okay, I'm not totally worthless.
Yeah, because you're here listening
you have
to something
enough
you like.
Stuff. Yeah, so you've done so much stuff, you don't realize because you're always focused on what you're doing and you're not doing it right and you're not doing enough right now.
Yeah.
But then I don't really look back. I have to consciously, like, turn around and go like, oh, look at all the stuff I did, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's something that we should all meditate on. Once a day or once a week at the very least. I don't do it either. But just to think about all the things that you have accomplished, you know. The thing is, though, it never seems like it's enough. And I suspect even if you are more successful, that you still feel like it's just a measuring stick, right? I'm sure you've talked to people about this, right? So when's the end, you know? When do you feel like you've suddenly gotten somewhere? Surely there's got to be somewhere where you feel like this is a good place to be,
right?
You know, I mean, for me, it would be nice to go to different cities, play music, and do a mural, some kind of public mural, and have it all paid for, right? Now, if I got to that position where I was being invited to do a residency and then play in some theater and then do like a mural in some city, let's say Paris, right?
Yeah.
I got invited to go. They're gonna all expenses paid, they're gonna pay me for my time. To me right now, sitting talking to you, that would be the dream. But not only that, but like it would sustain itself. You know, Madrid next, then something in San Francisco, right? So I'm telling you, that's my dream, right? So if I got there, would I be happy there? Or when I say it in a few seconds, it sounds fucking awesome, right? Yeah. That sounds like I'm not taking into consideration the times I'm going to be physically sick or the times I'm going to miss my wife and my 5-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Or the time that I nearly got run over by a bus or they didn't pay me enough or whatever. So that's what I think happens, you know, all of those little things. And then when I'm done that last gig, it's like I have to worry about, you know, or I have a manager who's not taken care of or the secretary's not. I mean, I get it. Yeah.
You know, I was just flashing on something. Didn't we play at Quackenbush's like on a Sunday afternoon, like you and me and John Sanchez and Patty Griffin?
No. Are you talking Quackenbush's?
I'm talking about Quackenbush's on 41st. Like, we all went over there at like 4 o'clock on a Sunday and played.
No.
I think Kerry Clark played, too.
Really?
Yeah, you didn't play on that day?
No. I mean, I don't remember. In Hyde Park?
Yeah.
The Quackenbush's were just outside?
It was like
outside?
2001 or 2002.
Would we have played inside?
We played inside, yeah.
No, I don't remember that.
In the room to the side where you go to the bathroom? Like,
yeah,
I know that. We just kind of like cleared out the tables and we played in there.
No, I don't remember. That's
no
just like
microphones
solo?
Or no nothing. Yeah, we just sat all and just like jammed and everyone played songs. Yeah, I can't even remember how it came up. I just remember, I don't remember if it was Kerry going like, hey, you guys want to go down to Quackenbush's and play?
And we all agreed?
I don't remember how it worked. I just remember that there was a bunch of people hanging out and then Kerry asked if we wanted to go do that. And it was like right, like now.
Yeah.
And so we just like grabbed our guitars and walked over there from Avenue H.
No, I don't remember that. No. And I think I would have, but
yeah,
you're scaring me, Johnny.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm just like, I don't, maybe it's early dementia setting.
No.
It could be, though. No.
So how is it having a five-year-old?
Oh, it's great. It's really fun to kind of revisit your own childhood through your own kid,
yeah.
You know. And I'm so glad I did it. My wife really kind of made that happen. Because I think like a lot of people, was skeptical about having a kid, and the responsibility of it all seemed pretty daunting. And not like financially speaking.
No, but I know what you mean.
It's just like, oh my God. And I think I had a lot of life and death issues. And I think it was a lot to do with myself. Suddenly I have to be responsible for this kid. I think that was overwhelming to me. I had a lot of anxiety about it. Wasn't until the ultrasound when the doctor said, oh, it looks like a little boy, that I started to feel grounded and like, oh wow, this is going to be a person. You know, but the year leading up to doing the deed was like, oh my God, am I really contemplating this? This is going to happen. And then my wife got pregnant and I was like kind of a jerk. I mean, I was nice to her, but I was just like, oh my God, wait, kind of thing. But ultrasound happened. It's going to be a little boy. We're going to name him Francis. Then I started to relax. And then by the time he was born, I was pretty good emotionally. And then thank God it was not about me, it was about just raising this person, because so much is just about me.
See, that's what
and
I'm scared of.
Still
that's
is
what I'm scared of losing it being about me.
No, do it. I can tell you, I mean, you know, cleaning the diapers and all that, yeah. And sometimes you get lucky and you're not going to have sleepless nights, and our kids slept really well, but whatever it is,
it's not that stuff that scares me. It's like I hate that song, Dad. Does he like your music? I'm scared the kid's going to judge my music and handle it.
Oh, he will. Yeah.
Yeah.
He'll hate it and love it and look back and think fondly of it. Well, for me, it was really nice to sort of still feel the fire to write songs and do paintings. But I looked at it differently. Because it's a life-changing thing, as people are. And I don't want to bore anybody with, oh, it's so profound and awesome. But it is profound and awesome. So it kind of took the spotlight off me in my own mind.
Right.
Like, I don't have to, I have to take care of this person now. And I really want to do that and not kind of put down what I'm doing. So it was really helpful for me in that sense. Because A, I get to hang out with this little person and take care of them. So right away, I didn't feel like I was wasting my time, or I didn't feel like I was just kind of not doing my art and music. I felt like I don't need to do art and music. I need to tell my wife, take care of this kid. And not only I wanted that, I wanted to kind of go down that rabbit hole. So I did that for 2 or 3 years. And the whole time, always writing and doing painting. So it wasn't like, you know, the kid sleeps.
Yeah.
Right? Mom has him for a while. So it's not like you lose all this time. You have to be a little more focused with, you know, when you're going to do your music or your art. But that's easy enough, you know. I think of all the times I've wasted just hanging out in bars, like not creating and just...
Exactly.
And that was great. I loved going to parties. And So I kind of like, oh, well, this is... I'm not going out drinking, but I'm taking care of my kid, you know. I'm still finding time to do what I need to do. The thought of having a second kid, though, that's...
That's a lot.
Well, yeah. If you got two guys, you got one who's five and one who's pooping at 2 years old. That, you know, and if you don't have any help, we don't. Our families aren't here. You know? My family's in Vermont. Yeah. My wife Melissa's family's from Brisbane, Australia. Yeah. So, you know, so and we're not wealthy enough where you would just would be daycare would be an option or or have a nanny or whatever. Otherwise, I would entertain the idea of having more kids. But anyway,
that's interesting.
Have it, do it, John. Oh my God, easy for me to say.
But a lot of people say that. Bob Schneider said that to me too. Exactly, exactly that. Do it, just do it.
Does he have kids?
Amazing. He's got
really?
Yeah.
He does.
Huh? Wow. He just had a second one recently.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Over the last like month and a half, I think. So tell me about the Orange Mothers. How did you get that band together?
It was, I came down here and I did Hollywood Indians for a while with the different members. And then Orange Mothers it started as a concept, and the concept was real simple. We would have people, we had a fake band up front and behind a big curtain, which I painted, a big canvas I painted, maybe it was 8 feet long by 5 or 6 feet high. I don't remember the dimensions, but it would hide the real band behind. We were behind this big canvas that I painted. We did at the old Liberty Lunch. Mm-hmm. So the first time we did this twice. We both did it at Liberty Lunch. And the first time we played, we said we were from San Francisco. Orange Mothers from San Francisco, you know. And so people came to the show and they saw like a fake band.
Yeah.
And the fake band was two guys and two gals. And the singer had a guitar, nylon string guitar with no strings, right? It was bizarre.
How cool, though.
And the drummer, our drummer, was actually in the fake band with drums. So we played behind him, with the amps were behind him. And it was such a production. I mean, it was like performance art mixed with rock and roll. Mixed with a light show, and that was really, it took a lot out, and that was the whole idea, was to have this fake band, and other people have done it. It wasn't like, oh, it's all new or anything. And Liberty Lunch, the first show was great. The second show, there was maybe 4 or 5 people showed up, because people were like, oh, we've seen that, done that kind of thing. But the first show was like 150 people came, just because we put up posters all over the place, and we were just talking, and people were curious, you know, fake band, what's going on. And
I played to 11 people once there at Liberty.
11, yeah.
And that is a
but that was not an empty five, ass right?
Room. No. I remember it was 11 because of the money. And I remember what was her name? The couple,
Jeanette,
going like, you know, you guys. And it was a Wednesday, and it was kind of.
Oh, they were so sweet.
Yeah, they were Jeanette, always so nice. Yeah,
they played ball with me. They were. I think I even played there as Hollywood Indians. Jeanette, and I forget the guy's name too. They live in on 9th Street. What was the guy's name? Mark and Jeanette.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so after that, when I realized I couldn't sustain that level of like performing and getting the fake band, so there was like 10 people involved in this whole project.
Yeah.
It just quickly turned into, oh, let's just play shows. And we played Hole in the Wall, Electric Lounge back in the day. Yeah. And members came and went, but the core members were always me and Jeff Johnson.
Right.
And then in the...
I remember seeing you guys at the Hole in the Wall.
Probably Hole in the Wall was our...
Yeah.
Early on was our place. And John Sanchez came... He was playing with Flying Saucers at the time, but you can relate to all this. And then he had this old Farfisa, and he said, let me sit in some rehearsals with you. And when he started playing the Farfisa with all kinds of effect pedals, we took like a really like poppy, it was like opened all these doors, like wow, this keyboard and the piano sound, was like, it was great. And he inspired me to write more pop songs, kind of like Squeeze, kind of like Flaming Lips, and kind of I don't know. And he stayed with us for a while because he's always moving on or whatever, you know. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, I just want to do a few gigs. I don't want to actually be in the band.
Right, right.
But I went and found somebody to replace John, who was playing piano and organ or whatever. James Walsh. We call him Jamesy Wamesy. He was just a friend. He's a performance artist. And he wasn't on the scene at all, but he could play really well. So he kind of he filled out the Orange Mothers. And then we did like Big Blue House album. We did traditional love album. John Sanchez played on the very first cassette. Well, it was a cassette. It was Plane Crash City with some. That's a great album. Jeff Hoskins did that album. He was the engineer.
I love Jeff, yeah.
I love Jeff too. It's $10 an hour and he had a place on.
That's so cool. Yeah, no, I remember those kind of studios where like a dude had an ADAT or like an 8-track reel to reel. And like a microphone.
Yeah, well, he was actually more thorough than that, but. Totally lo-fi and totally, like, we didn't know what we were doing, but the songs are really good. That's one of my favorite albums. And anyway, so Orange Mothers was, like, from 96, 95, 96, yeah. Right up till 2005. So about, like 10 years.
Yeah. Didn't you guys do a record with Mark Addison?
No, I did a solo project with Mark Addison, yeah. But the highlight, the heyday of the Orange Mothers was playing a Saturday a month at the Continental Club.
Yeah.
And people would come to see us. We'd get maybe 7,500 people, and then just people who were... We played there with the Barkers, and then mm-hmm. Little Captain Travis later on. And Steve at the Continental. You can't play the Continental unless you're going to draw people.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember there was a sweet spot for a couple of years where I could call Steve, and he'd call me right back. Like, yeah, well, how about this Saturday? Like, I was like, oh, this is how this works. We get people in the door... Then the club wants to play
by. It all changes.
I knew
when
that.
You're making
someone money. I was like, really?
Yeah.
And then when I tried to go back in the Continental Club with, hey Steve, I got this solo thing. I was like,
anyhow. That's happened to me too,
right.
So many times.
But Steve, it's me. You said I was the next big thing. What the fuck?
Yeah. That wasn't you. It was the whole group together. Those things are funny, man, and you know what's good is to be able to get, like, those things devastate people, and I could tell it at some points in my life I was getting, like, pissed, you know what I mean, at the world, at everyone.
Yeah. No, I was pretty upset about that, but I knew why.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's just a fact of life, and...
I did play it a few times at the lounge. I really like playing it upstairs at the lounge.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love it up there.
But everyone wants to play there.
Yeah.
And I've played there, you know, a handful of times. We did like a month residency a couple of times.
Here's something that happened to me in November. I was up there, and you know Celeste?
Yeah.
Celeste is up there, and she's like, oh, I was like, man, you know, I love this room so much. I would love to do something up here. And she said, oh, you know what? We'd love to have you. And I was like, no shit. She's like, yeah, there's a slot opening up. But can you start a funk band? I was like, no. I thought you wanted me. She's like, no. You get put together something that's real cool. And you can play here, right. But not you doing your stuff.
Right.
But it didn't kill me. I understood. I was like, this room is like, it's got that kind of vibe, you know?
Yeah. No, the same thing with me. I got in there, David Garza was kind enough to let me play. He was doing a show there a couple years ago. We both did an art show up there, actually, because he's an artist
as
well.
Artist, yeah.
He is a great artist. So we kind of, gallery, we shared the wall space, and then it went really well. But when I tried to go back there a while ago, it was like, they're just booked up, you know? And it's not even a personal thing, but...
No. I think also, there's a lot of stuff that goes into things. And I don't think people, there's like this, you can't sustain like a total level of, you know, great career all the time. I mean, this business is just for everyone. It's just up and down and up and down.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of being able to like stay afloat, you know, while everything's happening. Even when you're on a high tide to be aware that, you know, this is not gonna
last
forever.
Yeah. No. How could it?
Don't take the whole thing too seriously.
Yeah. No, that it's a balancing act between taking it serious enough to produce some good stuff, but not so serious, and also not take it personal when people don't get back to you. via email, used to be the phone. It's not personal, but I will tell you now, and who's ever going to listen to this, that's my Achilles heel. I have a problem with being ignored.
We all do.
I'm fine with rejection. And in fact, when people say, don't email me anymore, we're not interested in what you're doing, I'm like, I'm relieved. You know, it's not even, my first thing is just relief. It's not like, oh, how could they say that? It's just like, great. I don't have to, like, try and convince these people anymore. And I understand why people don't get back to you, because there's a lot of people they don't want to deal with. And it's not like, they just probably literally don't have time to go, we're not interested, right?
They just have a lot of stuff going on.
But that can keep me up at night. If I email somebody, especially like the second or third time, and they're not getting back to me, I think of things like going, I'm going to email them back and just go, hey, thanks for the gig. We're super excited. When do we load in? Just to see if they'll go, wait a minute, dude.
That's so great.
Is that great, or is that going to bite me karmically? I'm asking you seriously.
Like, depends on the person's sense of humor. Because if that was me booking that gig and I was ignoring you and you sent the thing like that and then I wrote back to you and you were like, well, whatever, I would give you a gig. Because I'm like, this guy's got, there's got to be something to this dude.
But would you?
He's this insane.
But would
I want him to play my club.
Well, what would you say to me in that email? So I say, I'm going to play. When do we load in, Johnny? Thanks for the gig. We're all super excited.
I haven't answered any of your emails. I'm looking through my correspondence. I don't see any. I don't see anything going on here. Maybe you got me confused with somebody else who gave you a gig.
Okay. Now, how do I respond to that? Do I go, made you look like got you to email me back?
Get you a gig. With me.
With you, right? That might piss the other person off.
I don't know about Steve.
Well, no, Steve will just say no. Steve or Celeste, just no. So I don't take it personally. That's kind of like, that'll keep me up at night. Like, you know what? But I know the right answer is not to get absorbed. That's just not, you know, it's not healthy, I don't think. But part of me just relishes doing stuff like that, you know? And that actually worked one time at Stubbs when Charles Atoll used to book Stubbs. Uh-huh. I left him a long message saying, we want $5,000. We want a lot of cocaine. And we want some dancing girls. And maybe we'll consider playing at your club. Yeah. Something like that.
Stop harassing me till you have filled my rider. You're right. Click.
And he thought it was funny and gave us a gig.
Right? See?
So that worked with him. Yeah.
That's funny.
That is funny.
So now you're playing with Jeff on Wednesdays.
I do a show on Wednesdays at the Hole in the Wall.
6 to 8. I'm sorry I didn't go last Wednesday.
Oh, whatever. I think we're going to be there for the rest of April, maybe May.
Okay.
Because there's nothing happens there. So I don't think there's a lot of people want to play there. And it's really nice. It's on the corner stage. And we're not playing too loud. Jeff's singing through the phone. He's playing plays a saw. I'm playing guitar and singing. And we've been doing that for years now. So it's entertaining. And you can come there and drink some beer and talk quietly or not. Yeah. Sometimes people really will listen.
Yeah.
Depends. Sometimes they talk, but it's really like low key. So it's not like we're in concert and you have to sit still and listen to every stupid word. It's like you can or you can't. You know, people come in there and they go right out back and start smoking and eating and drinking out back. So the Hole in the Wall is all changed. But the very beginning of the Hole in the Wall is like it was 15 years ago. You still have that scuzzy green carpet on that corner stage.
There's nothing I love more than that stage.
Yeah.
That stage and the Continental Club stage, they're just like...
They haven't messed with
the...
Right. And the guy who, Will, it's like done that on purpose. He wants to drink there because he used to go there as a patron to the Hole in the Wall. You know who I'm talking about, Will Danner?
No.
Anyway, he used to go see all bands in the late 90s, early 2000s there. So he kept that Hole in the Wall, that first part we walk in, just like 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah,
exactly the same. So we're playing there on Wednesdays from 6 to 8. And sometimes I'm going to have guests come and play. I'm not sure how that's going to work. But 6 to 8, and it's very laid back. It's really fun for me and Jeff because we get to kind of be with each other, have a few beers, and it's kind of practicing, keeping our chops up, and I can't say enough about it. I bike there. I live on the east side, so I can put my guitar. I'm like this weirdo guy with a guitar on my back, and I'm biking to my gig, and I'm 50 years old, and I'm like setting up my gear. It's like, I love it. It's perfect.
Yeah,
for
I
me.
Love that.
Yeah. And then I bike back after 2 or 3 hours. It's like once a week is just all I need.
Solid bike ride.
And sometimes people are there, sometimes not. You know, sometimes when there's like
that's
10
the way
or 15.
It is with the weekly gigs.
It's just that way. And I don't, it's like I'm so fine with that. You know, of course I would like more people to show up, but, and sometimes they do, but yeah. Oftentimes it's just a handful of people.
Yeah.
But sometimes a lot of old friends who I haven't seen for 5 or 6 years or even 10 years ago. I heard you're playing, I made it out. I'm like, oh, great to see you. So that's cool, you know.
Yeah. What are you going to, when are your records coming out?
I just put out a record, and then I'm going to, this second record, I'm looking for a label to help me out, or a mark, I don't know. I don't want to, I'll make a few copies of myself, and I'm just going to try and shop it around. I've been talking to local people.
Oh, right, you
people.
Said that in an email.
Modern Outsiders, yeah. One, Western Vinyl are local people, but these days, they all say, we'll get back to you if we're interested. I guess they always said that, you know. But it's really hard. It seems harder than it did 20 years ago to get people to come see you. And the thing that really bugs me is an album is so constrained. An album is so one way. Like I'm singing the song the same way in an album over and over again. But you see somebody live as a whole nother monster.
Yeah.
So I don't like sending albums to, if they don't like the album, they're not going to want to come see us play, you know. So it's like, what I'm trying to say is like live, just,
you might get something.
I just do
different stuff
so spontaneous, or change the lyrics, and seeing Jeff singing on the telephone, and Jeff's got this crazy white beard now.
Yeah,
he looks
yeah.
like a trapper from California or something, or a guy who's panning for gold. And then I'm kind of a weird-looking guy, so you have this really great dynamic on stage, and the fact that we've played together for 25 years, it's just like...
That's so rare,
even if you
too.
Didn't like it, yeah. you could tell these guys...
You can appreciate
it. You can appreciate it,
yeah.
So I'd love for somebody who could help us out to come see that, and that's another reason I got the weekly, and it's kind of like a little showcase every Wednesday. Hey, if you like what you heard, you could come see us play. Because people get it when I get it when I see a band play. You gave me your CD, it's like, I might like it. But if I saw you delivering those songs and singing them, and I could tell if you were doing it for real or if you were comfortable with yourself or whatever, I'd be like, awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I can get that vibe. That's going to make a difference.
You guys are like some weird Joe Perry and Steven Tyler.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no, but it's that
one-two
punch.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
I bet you guys
we don't
are
even
friends.
Look at each other.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot in common, actually. I mean, Jeff is, like, we hang out musically, but, and we have dinner. He's like a brother. He's really yeah. like family. So it goes beyond, like we don't necessarily want to hang out together. You know, like, you love your brother, right? But you don't want to, like, hang out with him and
you
like,
have
go.
Have your time where it's magical when you're on stage together. And
it's magical
music.
There, yeah. or, you know, if he ever needed money or he wants to come and sleep on my couch or I want to sleep on his, that's all, you know, that's all going to
sure,
happen.
Yeah.
yeah. We're real comfortable when we do anything. We love each other. It's awesome. But we don't like hang out and like play Clash of Clans together or pinball or I don't know. It's just a different relationship. His interests are different than mine.
Yeah.
But somehow we have a lot of share the same kind of sensibilities when it comes to music because we appreciate each other on that level. And then we've grown so close that, you know, he'll watch my house if I'm out of town, that kind of thing. Or he's kind of like a second dad to Francis, you know, my son. Yeah, I mean, we all have somebody like that in our lives, and he's that guy for me.
So are you having an art show this coming May?
Thank you, Johnny. Good. Yeah.
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 Okay, because I just wanted to make sure. It's an art show, Pump Project, opening Saturday, May 30th.
Where yes. at Pump Project's on Shady Lane. It's a Pump Project complex or gallery, and it's going to be a show of large paintings. I'm calling the show Survive Yourself. And it's not a conceptual show whatsoever. It's just these big, large paintings that I've done about three years of worth of work. And they're just meant to be, there's a sense of humor with all of them. They all work together. And the title, Survive Yourself, is just kind of a catchy title, and it's also kind of what I've done for the last 26 years here in Austin, musically and artistically, just kind of survived myself and not taken my ego too seriously, and, you know,
yeah,
here I am after 26 years still painting and doing music, so...
And on your music site, which is to see the art stuff, you go to ethanazarian.net, and for the music, you go to ethanazarianmusic.com. They both have links to each other.
Yeah.
So if you go to one, ethanazarian.net for the art, ethanazarianmusic.com. I find you also hopelessly original and refreshingly out of touch.
Thank you, Tony.
We didn't even get to talk about like Spotify and stuff like that. Do you even? You seem like a guy that's never heard Skrillex.
No. I don't know what that is.
Yeah. Like, it's a dude. It's like a world famous DJ. I made myself go find out what it was after I heard people talk about it and I saw him in Rolling Stone, but it's not something that you need in your life.
I think Orange Mothers are on Spotify. People have spotted us on Spotify.
Okay.
But I think I need to start selling stuff in that way. I mean, I don't know. It's that's how people do it now, right?
Yeah.
You make a deal.
But it's kind of like Netflix. What they do is it's a person, because I pay for it. I can't remember if it's I think it's $14.99 a month.
And then you get
access to all the music.
Right. And then they're supposed to catch up with whatever you buy, right? Or whatever they send you.
You get.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like streaming. You just play it, you know, and if you're out of range, you can't hear it.
Right.
But as far as your music goes, there's a page of music that you can listen to. A lot of the stuff, is that one whole album that
you
made?
That's one whole album, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I put the latest album I did.
How do people get them physically? They can go to iTunes?
Waterloo.
Dang,
right. But
they don't live in Austin, they can go to iTunes?
I don't think so.
Okay, but if you live in Austin, then definitely go to Waterloo.
But I should probably put it out on iTunes, right?
Yeah.
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 Do you know how to do that? I'm joking.
I know
enough people who
I might not actually know, because the last things that I've put out. I have a SoundCloud.
But or SoundCloud, right? I can just go figure that out. Yeah. Are you singing yourself, like playing your own songs?
Uh-huh.
And you've been doing that for a while?
I've been doing that since I was.
I mean,
like,
forever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Since I was like, you know, 18.
Yeah.
I was in bands before that, but other people's bands, and I was too scared to write songs or let people hear the songs I was writing because I thought they were terrible.
If I go see you play now, what am I going to see?
Well, I am in a cover band called Skyrocket.
Right.
With people you might know, like members of The Real Heroes.
Yeah.
Trish and Darren Murphy.
Yes.
And we've been doing this for a long time. It's called Skyrocket. It was called KTL Hit Machine. In fact, we borrowed Jeff's phone for a show we did. But when I play as myself, yes, it's my own music.
And
I'm still writing and recording.
And playing guitar.
Playing guitar and keyboards and singing. And
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've also been doing, there's a song actually today that comes out. Somebody covered one of my songs.
Awesome.
It comes out today, a band called The Dirty Knees. And I just did a bunch of stuff on the new Kimmy Rhodes album.
Wow.
Yeah.
A bunch of stuff like playing music, writing stuff?
She did one of the songs, one of my songs, and then we wrote a song together, and then I played guitar and piano and stuff on the whole record.
That's pretty awesome, man.
Yeah. That's what I like about getting older, is I think when I was younger, I was so focused on my thing, and you know what I mean? And there was a point, I remember, in the late 90s.
Did you get to perform it?
And you're just out on the road all the time. It's all about you.
Yeah.
But then in the late 90s, once I actually like got a record deal and stuff, I just started playing with so many people.
Yeah, opened a lot of doors.
And just doing more stuff. And just like, I find that the more I do, the happier I am.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you're the same way.
Yeah.
But I mean, the more outside of, like, the more different things I do, the busier I am with different things to do, the happier I am, as opposed to being super busy with just one thing.
Yeah, I can do that with art. Like, there's at any given time, there's some kind of project I'm working on, or mural idea I'm working on. With music, not so much, you know, but I'm trying to change that. I'm kind of in a point in my career where I'm trying to give more energy and time towards the music. Like I said, I'd like to go to Europe, and I'd like to be able to do some touring.
I'd like to see more people hear your stuff.
I mean, a lot of people agree, but it's just a matter of marketing and finding the right people. It's just a matter of marketing.
And a lot of money. Well, is there anything that I'm missing? People can find your music again at EthanNazarianMusic.com or EthanNazarianMusic.net for the art, and you have a show at the Pump Projects opening Saturday, May 30th?
5 to 9.
Yeah,
but people are going to hear all about that.
Okay.
I'm going to publicize it well and do
good.
All my...
And they can find you on Facebook.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yep.
But look for the Orange Mothers on Spotify.
And Spotify, yeah. And eventually I'll put some stuff on iTunes or Bandcamp or something and sell my CD that way.
Good.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks
Johnny.
For coming by, man.
That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Gone our separate ways. Farewell, my old friend.
What a great guy. Ethan Nazarian, man. Fabulous talent, amazing artist, amazing musician, and just a great, great guy. I love talking to him, love hanging out with him. I love this record, Farmhouse Recordings, he and Jeff Johnston did. It's Ethan Nazarian and Jeff Johnston, Farmhouse Recordings. Get out there and pick that up if you can. Find his music at EthanNazarianMusic.com, and then you can find his art at EthanNazarian.net. All right, thanks for coming by, Ethan. I think you're a great guy. All right, while you're out there checking out Ethan's stuff on the internet, don't forget that you can find us on, of course, at the Podbean page, howdidigethere.podbean.com, but you can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and you can also subscribe on Stitcher, the mobile app. If you don't have it yet and you're into podcasts, get Stitcher. And also, you can like our Facebook page, find pictures of people like me and Ethan on there, and all kinds of guests, updates on guests that have been on the show, new records that they're putting out, shows that they're playing, just things that are going on, general mayhem, if you will. Okay, you can do that on the Facebook page, and if you want to get really involved, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Thank you to Ethan Nazarian for coming by. He has always been a hero of mine, and I'm really glad to have gotten to sit down and have this conversation with him. All right, let's hear some more music from Ethan Nazarian and Jeff Johnston from their album Farmhouse Recordings. All right, you guys have a great, great, great day. Let's get down.
Have been hung out to dry. Cold hard reality's moving in fast. Money's all gone, there's nothing to show. Dark days out there on the horizon. Sick and tired of spending and consuming. Tired of worrying about what's right and what's wrong. Seems you're nobody if you don't know somebody. Try as we might, it's sure hard to slow this world down. On the highway, the chickens are crowing for the moon. There's bats up there in the bell tower. They say Jesus Christ, he'll be rolling around here soon. Sweet hope, she stands at the end of the tunnel. Whispering low as she holds you close. Yeah, that's right, my name is Hope. Keep moving towards the light. Don't give up the ghost, all is well. I've been sent down here to save you.